G'day, Paul Barclay with you this Monday evening on RN. Or perhaps you're listening via the web at abc.net.au or to our podcast. You're with Big Ideas. Thanks for tuning in. It has been said of Australia that ours is a uniquely peaceful historical story. No wars have ever been fought on Australian soil, the famous war correspondent Charles Bean once asserted. Yet, according to historian Henry Reynolds, this is based on a fallacy. War did rage in Australia for almost 150 years. From around the 1790s to the 1920s, brutal frontier conflict occurred across the continent as colonial settlers fought to wrest control of the land from Indigenous Australians. Tens of thousands of Aborigines and Islanders were killed, thousands of settlers too. More than merely a series of conflicts, this violence, says Henry Reynolds, clearly constitutes frontier warfare. But unlike other wars in which Australians have fought, we do not commemorate or recognise the frontier wars. Australian War Memorial Director Brendan Nelson says the memorial is not the place to tell this story, important as he acknowledges it is. Henry Reynolds is perhaps our best-known historian and author of many groundbreaking books. He maintains if we are to move forward as a nation and achieve reconciliation, we must acknowledge the frontier wars fought on Australian soil. He has been, as he tells me, a controversialist over the years, and though he's slowed down, he appears to have lost none of his ability to provoke. He joined me at Avid Reader to talk about his new book, Forgotten War. Thanks for coming, Henry.
My pleasure.
We are all aware, most of us anyway, of the frontier conflict between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians, the colonial settlers, but we don't tend to define it as warfare. What makes it war? What defines it as such?
Well, you can do the obvious thing by talking about the longevity of it, the geographical spread of it. You can talk about the numbers of people who were killed. Now, all of those, I think, point in the direction of war. But why I think it is war is because it was about very important issues. Now, in some ways, that seems to me to be the fundamental difference between attitudes in the past where, even if there was a recognition of frontier warfare, it was seen more as a matter of banditry or criminality because the Europeans had started with the premise that the Aboriginal people of Australia neither had property rights, they didn't own the land, as we know, nor were they sovereign. They didn't actually have the sovereign authority over the land. So if there was conflict, it couldn't be about those big issues. Now, if, as now, we clearly have to accept that they were landowners, I mean, the highest court in the land defined that now over 20 years ago, and it's quite clear from everything we know that Aboriginal society had government and laws and therefore exercised sovereignty. So if you have conflict which changes the ownership and the sovereignty of a whole continent, then this is a war, and a very important war. It's one of the most important wars of the 19th and early 20th century because it does change the ownership and possession and the control of a vast area of land.
And when you say it's war, you're not talking about it being civil war, are you? You're talking about it being nation versus nation warfare, really. Because it's hard to classify. For it to be a civil war, you'd have to classify the Aborigines as British subjects upon colonisation, wouldn't you?
Yes, which was the legal theory. I mean, by the 1830s, the imperial government said no war can exist with these people, they are British subjects. But that's not the way in which most people, from the governors down to the frontier settlers, saw it. They realised that it was just a fiction that these people were British subjects, that they were indeed engaged in a serious struggle. And there were indeed, the legal theory that they were all British subjects was not recognised by some of the key legal figures. I mean, the first Chief Justice of South Australia, a man called Cooper, recognise that the settlers were moving out into the country of foreign nations. So that legal question was always contentious, and it's in a way it hasn't been resolved because no Australian court has tackled the question of sovereignty. Because they say, no, we can't deal with that. Now, if they can't deal with it, then the only avenue, it seems to me, is to seek an opinion from the International Court of Justice. But quite clearly, what we are dealing with is a war, and I would argue the most important war, with the exception, I think, of the Pacific War, the most important war that Australia's experienced, more important than the First World War, because it was about, it was in Australia, about Australia, but above all, about these very important questions.
The archives, I was interested in reading too, in Britain and Australia, refer to the fact that it was a war, refer to the early governors, like Tasmania's Governor Arthur, and military officers referring to it as warfare. So it was clearly understood way back as war, even if there are some people today who find this a rather uncomfortable truth.
Yes, I mean, those early governors are all military officers, or, you know, Philip wasn't a military officer, but I mean, Macquarie and Arthur and Hutt, all of these people had had military careers. They'd been soldiers in the great wars of the Napoleonic period. And Governor Arthur is the most interesting in a way because he was in Tasmania for 12 years throughout that period of the of what's known as the Black War, which was known at the time as the Black War. And in his correspondence inside Tasmania, in the letters he wrote back to Britain, in his own private correspondence, he says this is a war. We are engaged in a war. Now, they often add a, you know, a qualifying adjective, you know, a secret war, a horrifying war, a kind of war. I mean, they realise that it is sui generis. It's a particular sort of war. But most of these military officers had been in the Peninsular War in Spain, and they knew what a guerrilla war was, where the local people took up arms against the invading army, of the French army. So that when they talked about guerrilla war, they knew exactly what they were dealing with, and they regarded it as war. But, I mean, anyone who's read the Queensland material will be aware that they talked about war all the time. I mean, one of these days someone will simply count up the countless number of times people talked about war. And, as I say, it isn't just the extent and the violence and the suffering of it, but it's that it was about very major issues. I mean, one of the things that made me come back to this was when I was reading, I actually was looking at writing about war and reading about it, and I read the great theorist of war, Clausewitz, the great Prussian theorist of war. I mean, still regarded as the one great war book about war. And Clausewitz said, look, it's not the battles, it's not the coming and going, it's not the commanders and the bravery of soldiers. It is what are the great strategic objectives. And that is what makes it a war, rather than just a, you know, an insurgency or a crime wave. The great strategic objectives. The great strategic objectives in Australia was the ownership and control of a whole continent, the resources of which we all live on and buy and from.
The other point you make is, to those who don't think it's war, you offer this. If there was no war, then thousands of Aborigines were murdered in a century-long, continent-long crime wave tolerated by government. After reading that, I thought it was perhaps preferable to think of it as war, and that perhaps we should take some reassurance from it being war.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the alternative is, yes, it was murder, you know, rather than a struggle about real and important questions. Now, there certainly were, you know, the idea that the settlers went out and, you know, that was just a sport, they killed people for sport. This diminishes the whole question. It was about very important questions, and therefore, I think it should be seen as something of great consequence, in which a lot of settlers died. I mean, you know, in the Tasmanian case, 250 died in a few years. This is a lot of people dying in a small colonial society. And they often died violently. So 250 Europeans, certainly more Aborigines. So, you know, this makes it something we should recognise. And what I begin with a letter written in 1830 by a young settler in Tasmania, a young official in Tasmania. And the question arose when they had actually taken a group of Aborigines with the last conflict of the war, they had killed a very prominent settler, not just a convict, a very prominent settler had killed him. And they actually had witnesses, they took them prisoner, they took them to Launceston, and the question was, what are we going to do with these people? Are we going to put them on trial as murderers? And they undoubtedly they would have been convicted because there were witnesses. Or are we going to treat them as something else? And this long letter is extraordinary because it says, look, these people aren't criminals. They are patriots. They are defending their country against a foreign invader. They are doing what we would be expected to do. And if we didn't, if we hadn't behaved like that, we would be regarded as traitors and cowards. Why is it that we can't recognise?
I found that extraordinary, actually. This is in the 1830s, a correspondent who signs his name J.E. He's essentially anonymous, and his immediate response to hearing about these killings is typical of the time. His immediate response is, I think, let's exterminate the blacks.
The brutes, yes.
Or something like that. And then, upon reflection, he comes back and writes that piece that you referred to. When he starts to ask these questions, are they an injured people whom we have invaded and with whom we are at war? 1830s, how commonplace was it for these questions to be asked at that time by white settlers?
Yes, a minority always posed those questions in all parts of Australia, but this is by far the most articulate and the most detailed. And it does raise that question, why is it? You know, why is it that we can't identify with the Australians, the Indigenous Australians, who were fighting against the foreign invasion? This is the extraordinary thing. I can remember some years ago I was in South America and I was in Chile, and there is, of course, a famous long tradition of resistance by the Indians in the south, the Mapuche Indians. They're not treated well at the moment, but despite that, they recognise the great chief of the Mapuches, whose name to me is unpronounceable, as one of the heroes of Chile. And his statue is on an outcrop of rock in the very centre of Santiago, and apparently he is toasted in the officers' messes of the armed forces of Chile. They toast him as the person who was defending Chile. Now, that's partly because they became independent. Became an independent republic in the 1820s and don't feel any possible reason why they should identify with the Spaniards. And that is a very big difference.
Is the other reason why we find it hard to accept this that it is very threatening? We as a country have slowly begun to accept some of the wrongs that have been perpetrated on the original inhabitants of this continent. Slowly we're coming to terms with our history, but it strikes me that this is another big leap, an acknowledgement of frontier warfare, a reshaping, further reshaping of our foundation story. Is that why people are balking at accepting it, in spite of the mountain of evidence that you place in front of us in this book to demonstrate that it is clearly warfare?
Well, the interesting thing is that people like Ray Evans and many others, have been writing about this for many, many years. And in a sense, that's what provoked the history wars, and in particular, the writing of Keith Windschuttle. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that for a lot of people, that gave great relief. They were so pleased that someone had come along and said, you don't have to listen to these people. It wasn't like that at all. There's nothing you have to worry about. And there was that sense of relief. Now, there clearly is a real difficulty about coming to terms with the conflict. Real difficulty and hostility. It makes people angry. I'm also told that quite often students get very upset and they don't want to hear about this. And so you've got someone like John Howard, who personally was involved in this whole question, and said, as many people, I think, said, we must have stories that make young people proud of their history. these stories don't, they make them ashamed of our history. So therefore, we want another sort of story. And that is undoubtedly one of the reasons for the tremendous public, state-sponsored promotion of wars overseas, because it takes attention away from what happened within Australia. And in some ways, that was the most significant reaction to what they call black armband history. Mm. But much of the evidence, I mean, much of what I write is summing up things I've written before, and many others have provided the material. It was there, it's been there for 20 years and more.
It's not so much the evidence that's in question here, it's what flows from presenting the evidence and describing it as war, and it casts a pall, does it not, over the legitimacy of the nation?
Well, I often say to people, why is it that we seem to be proud of invading the Ottoman Empire or Turkey that presented absolutely no threat to Australia, and yet we seem to be ashamed about invading Australia? You know, it's a very, very strange way of seeing the world. And there are two things, two general things. One is, had we not experienced this extraordinary publicly funded campaign to celebrate war, to commemorate and even celebrate war, that we are seeing now and are going to see in even greater intensity over the next few years until presumably 2018. Had that not emerged in a quite unprecedented way, then I may not have returned to this material. But if we are going to make war as the central defining experience, and if, as Brendan Nelson says, the war memorial is the soul of the nation...
We will come back to that, by the way.
Yes. Then what do you do about this? You know, and one of the questions I ask is, are Indigenous Australians our countrymen or not? Now, if there's one thing the conservative Australians would say into that question, they'd say, yes, of course they are. We're all one people. We won't have any of this talk about separatism or sovereignty or self-determination because we are all one nation. You know, that's a viewpoint that you know, has a certain logic about it. But the corollary of that is, all right, well, if we are one nation, these people are our countrymen. How is it that we can ignore what happened to them when we rattle on endlessly about what happened to our soldiers overseas?
Some of the massacres of Aborigines in the 19th and 20th centuries are fairly well known to those people with a cursory interest in Australian history. There's the Mile Creek massacre, the Coniston massacre, perhaps the last such massacre. But what you point out in your book, what you marshal in your book, is just how widespread the conflict was right across the continent, as white settlements spread throughout the continent, so essentially did war. Can you talk a bit about that the extent of the warfare, how long it took place for, and where perhaps some of the more brutal incidents took place?
Well, it was an essential corollary of settlement. So it began as soon as the settlers began moving out into Aboriginal country, assuming that it was their land or it was theirs for the taking, assuming that they could use force to impose their will on the local people who, you know, it was inevitable that conflict was going to happen. Now, because Australia was such a vast area and the settlement, you know, they were still pushing into new country well into the 20th century, so the conflict accompanied that process of settlement, of pioneering settlement. It differed very widely, and as with the rest of the world, I mean, the 19th century saw a tremendous increase in the power of European weaponry, and this more than anything else explains the second great era of imperialism. You know, when in 1898, when the British mowed down 10,000 Sudanese with machine guns and lost about 100 themselves. You know, this was a period when there was a great disparity in force. Now, that happened in Australia, and by the end of the 19th century, you know, the Australian bushman, he knew the bush, he could live in the bush. They were hardy, they had horses, and they also had extremely powerful weapons that they could shoot people at a great distance. So the conflict changes very, very greatly compared to what it was in Tasmania, where the gap between the two was much, much closer.
Mm.
And therefore, the death rate among Europeans was significant.
So the contest was vastly unequal because of the superior weaponry that the settlers had. What were the various ways in which the Aboriginal people responded to that violence? How did they attempt to fight back?
Well, they basically had to try and keep out of the way of the Europeans, hiding, endeavouring not to be shot, because there was very little they could do with armed stockmen except surprising them and coming upon them by surprise and ambushing them and spearing them from behind. I mean, these things they endeavour to do, but as in the rest of the world, the balance had been dramatically tipped in favour of the Europeans.
Historian and author Henry Reynolds discussing Australia's frontier wars. You're with Big Ideas on RN and online. I'm Paul Barclay. You can podcast or stream this conversation and other Big Ideas discussions and talks from our website at abc.net.au/radionational. You can also get involved in the Twitterverse and tweet us at RN Big Ideas. From the late 19th century through to the middle of the 20th century, the story of Australia's frontier conflict was virtually airbrushed from history, says Henry Reynolds. The widely held view was that Australia, unlike other countries, had experienced a peaceful journey to nationhood. So when did we begin to talk about our more violent past? Let's return to my conversation with Henry Reynolds.
The significant event intellectually was the Boyer Lectures of Bill Stanner in 1968, when he talked about the Great Australian Silence. And there was a Great Australian Silence. And in that period, from, say, the 1880s right up to the 1960s, it was possible, because the Aborigines had been written out of the story, it was possible to talk about a uniquely peaceful society. I mean, I tell this story many times. When I arrived at James Cook University many years ago and was told I was teaching Australian history, and I was given as my textbook Gordon Greenwood. Greenwood edited Australia, Social and Political History. I mean, he was the great man of UQ, and it was an important book, and it was by far the most widely used textbook in senior schools and universities. And it had nothing about the Aborigines there. They weren't even in the index. They had been literally written out of Australian history. And so if you write them out, what are you left with? You're left with Ned Kelly, and you're left with a few other bushrangers, and you're left with Eureka Stockade, but a few unionists got killed. But apart from that, what a peaceful place it was.
Mm.
And that was a very nice story. But nations want nice stories.
We're willfully blind. Is that what you're suggesting by this title, Forgotten War? Because it implies that we knew there was a war, and indeed we spoke of it being a war at the time. It was reported in the newspapers as war. You go through the archives and you find reference to it being a war. This was not a hidden truth then. We are so reluctant to use that term today. We've chosen to forget, have we?
I think that's right. I think that's right. I mean, Forgotten War was very much imposed by the publishers. I wanted to call it Conquest, but they felt that Forgotten War, and I appeased them. I said, all right, if that's what you think is the best title, let's go with it. I'm not sure that Forgotten is quite the right word. I mean,
maybe I shouldn't be getting you to justify a title to a book that you're not entirely comfortable with.
it is a. I mean, at the beginning, yes, there were people who said, "Let's forget about it. Let's not talk about it." There was a willful hiding of it for people who were close to it. But on the other hand, there were old settlers who would say, and this is certainly so in Queensland, yes, of course, in the old days, I had to raise my rifle and, I had to shoot down the wretches. But by and large, it was best forgotten. It was best forgotten. And that is indeed what happened. But, I mean, it was never forgotten by Indigenous Australians. Right. I mean, they had their own history. They had their own history that they passed down by word of mouth. And they never had any doubt that this is what had happened to them and their people and their ancestors. But in terms of white history, yes, it was telling a nice story for the new nation.
Well, the death toll, the approximate death toll that you refer to in the books, around about 30,000 deaths of Indigenous Australians and perhaps several thousand settlers who die. And when you compare that to the wars that we commemorate from the Boer War, from Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, the Gulf War, those wars that I've just listed and the people who died there who are commemorated at the Australian War Memorial, of course, they rather pale into insignificance compared to the numbers who died in the frontier wars, don't they?
They do, they do. And I mean, I'm very modest. You know, when many years ago I said we must assume that, you know, it was at least 20,000. That was very early, you know, when we were beginning to do this work. And I mean, I think now 30,000 is indeed once again the bottom of the range. And I mean, the important work being done in Queensland by Robert Jensen and Ray Evans is going to push that figure up. And I think that is realistic, that it was more. It does get up to the range of the deaths in the Second and even the First World War.
Mm. Recently I spoke with the American novelist Philip Meyer, who, an interview, by the way, that I'll run on Big Ideas later this year. His new novel, The Sun, takes on the foundation mythology of America, the mythology of how the West was won. I'm wondering how the frontier wars in Australia compare with the so-called American Indian Wars. Are there some parallels there?
Yes, there are. I mean, in both New Zealand and the United States, there is a recognition that they were wars, the Maori Wars. But if you look up, official lists of American wars, then all the Indian wars are included, even quite small ones that I'd never heard of. So there is that recognition that what was happening was war. But this is partly because from the very start, the Indians were recognised as being the landowners and having a form of sovereignty. And so they were people with whom you could make treaties, but they were also people with whom you could go to war. So there's always that recognition in the United States. But in terms of the extent of the conflict and the number of peoples killed, I mean, the Australian frontier wars are certainly the equivalent of the wars on the Western Plains of the United States, and I think more significant than the Maori Wars.
Mm. You mentioned treaty there. Was there ever any suggestion at the time that this frontier conflict could have been avoided if compensation had been paid or if a treaty had been struck? Was that discussed? You know,
Yes, it was. I mean, that was exactly what George Arthur, the governor in Tasmania, I mean, I think probably the most competent British official that ever came to Australia. And Arthur indeed says this. He says, look, we made a great mistake when we first came to Australia that we had no treaty. There was no way in which we could deal with the question of land and the transfer of land. And he says this again and again. Now, it's my view that when he returned to Britain in 1836, he was there for 6 months. He then went on to Canada. And that was the period when they were discussing what to do about New Zealand. Now, I'm convinced that the Treaty of Waitangi came out of the Australian experience. Mm. But he said, you've got to go and start with a treaty, as much as anything else, to control the settlers. Mm. So, yes, there was that very keen sense that where it had gone wrong was that we didn't recognise these people as having land ownership or people who could actually engage in negotiation and to agree about treaties. Now, how that would have worked in Australia, it's not clear, but there certainly were people who saw this as the key problem.
There were no even tentative discussions, though, down that route?
Well, I mean, John Batman comes out of the Tasmanian experience and goes to Port Phillip with a treaty. Mm. Now, the problem with that is that, you know, it's a Crown prerogative. It's not... people can't make treaties, only the Crown. Mm. Not even Parliament, you know, it's an executive power, and no British government was going to recognise a private treaty. Mm. So Batman tried, and undoubtedly I think he knew that that was the thinking in Tasmania among the officials, that a treaty was what you required. So that was a serious attempt at a treaty. It wasn't just a ruse. I think it was a serious attempt to have a treaty. And there were always individuals who, in a way, worked out their own accommodation. Mm. And there are quite a few of those in Queensland. You know, when they're left to themselves, they decide they've got to come to some agreement. And what happens in North Australia? I mean, the important thing when it would have been possible for the settlers to have wiped out the Aborigines, it's the very time when they need them. They desperately need Aboriginal labour. And so once they have imposed their will, they don't want them killed, they want them to be alive, and they want children to be born, and they want more and more people they can train up to be their servants.
Mm. We tend to view the New Zealand Maori as a much more of a warrior culture than the Indigenous Australian. In fact, one of the myths around Australian Aborigines has tended to be over the years that they were passive. Yeah. How does the Aboriginal resistance compare to the Maori resistance?
Well, it's very different. I mean, in the classic period of the Maori Wars, I mean, the worst thing to do for any 19th century people resisting European imperialism was to get together in large groups and try and fight in a traditional way, because it simply meant the Europeans could use their firepower on you. And so the Maoris had a warrior culture, but it meant they had forts and they had guns and they came together in large groups. Now, that is exactly what couldn't happen in Australia, so therefore it was much more scattered. But certainly in terms of Tasmanian, I mean, these people had, they didn't even have spear throwers, they didn't have barbed spears, they only had clubs and spears, you know, without you know, just sharpened wood spears. And yet they were able to exact this incredible death rate on the Europeans. They were as effective as the Maoris were. Mm. Despite, as I say, having none of those things which were seen as being, which made Maoris worthy warriors. Mm.
Among the first names on the Australian War Memorial Roll of Honour are those from a New South Wales volunteer regiment who were sent to Sudan in 1885 to fight on behalf of the Empire against those who were rebelling against the British-backed regime in Sudan. Most of the people there died actually of disease. It was a rather ill-fated mission, actually. And yet those people who died there were acknowledged, and you can see their names listed in the War Memorial today. At the same time that this small regiment had been sent over to Sudan, the most brutal of the frontier conflict was taking place in Queensland, the victims of which have gone completely unrecognised. This is a very interesting part of the book, actually. You draw a stark contrast here. Tell us a bit more about that contrast that you establish in the book.
Yes, well, the Sudan contingent, I mean, it was a fateful event because it gave the British the idea that, you know, we can get these colonials to come and fight for us. So it was a most unfortunate example of what was to follow. But yes, they virtually saw no conflict. They died of typhoid. Not all of them even there. I mean, some of them died on the way home, and one of them died in Sydney. So he still is up there in the War Memorial. Whereas in North Australia around 1885, it was a period of intense conflict because they were moving into all of those areas in North Queensland, across the Northern Territory, the great expansion of the pastoral industry in the Northern Territory. They were moving up into Central Australia. They were moving in for the first time into the Kimberley, you know, looking for gold. And they were also, you know, there was intensifying activity on the sea frontier around Pearls, around Torres Strait and right across the north. So it was a period of probably among the most violent years in the frontier conflict.
Systematic killing,
yes.
Really.
Well, systematic in that the Aborigines were strongly resisting. Mm. And if you are going to try and occupy territory with a small number of people, then you're going to have resistance and you have to fight. And that, I mean, many of them say we have to fight for our life, and that is true. Mm. They were fighting for their lives, and they were certainly fighting for the country. But they were also fighting to survive against people who were extremely hostile and out to kill them. Mm. You know, the idea that somehow it was just because the settlers were brutal and racist, I mean, that doesn't touch on it, really. They were killing because they would have been killed themselves. Mm. Because they were, you know, right across North Australia, this vast territory, they were pushing into this new country. And so there is this extraordinary contrast. But I mean, the things they say about the Sudan contingent, I mean, you know, one of the comments is that when we saw our troops on parade with the guards, then we knew we had arrived, we had become a nation. So the idea that you became a nation in 1915 had been repeated at the Boer War and had been repeated in 1885. It just, we kept needing to be reborn through war.
As you say, we revere in Australia those who die in combat, especially in wars in foreign countries, and I suppose the revival in memorialising Anzac Day seems to suggest that the reverence to our war dead is, if anything, growing. I was interested in what you said earlier, that you think this has perhaps been an orchestrated campaign to take attention away from the frontier wars. But do you think that... can you ever imagine a time when we place the frontier wars in the same position in our national history, in our national imagination, as the great wars, the First and Second World War? Is that something you can ever imagine happening?
Well, I can imagine all sorts of things.
Realistically happening?
Well, the problem is that the current... it's not as if... it's not as if the great celebration, the cavalcade of celebration and commemoration of war has just happened spontaneously. It has been orchestrated and paid for on a massive scale by government. It is a degree of public interference in history that could only be compared with regimes that we would find distasteful. That is, it is a deliberate creation of this idea about war that is paid for. And I mean, they just recently voted $115 million. For the celebrations. This new government will no doubt add to that, and no one, as far as I know, even questioned that.
They would perhaps argue that they're simply responding to the community sentiment towards those people who sacrificed their lives for Australia.
Well, you can never tell with these. I mean, certainly there was an eager response in the community. I'm not suggesting it's entirely created by government, but I mean, tens and hundreds of millions of dollars goes wonders if you're promoting history. And remember, complete free access to all the schools in Australia. You send stuff to every school. You send curriculum material. You then follow up and ring schools and say, what battles are you teaching? I mean, there's a tremendous, tremendous campaign to indoctrinate the young in a way that if other societies did it, we'd be horrified.
In a review of your book by Peter Stanley, the former chief historian of the Australian War Memorial, he asks the question, can a devotion to Anzac coexist with a willingness to accept that frontier conflict occurred? What do you think?
I see absolutely no reason why not. I mean, there's no doubt that Anzac was a terribly traumatic event. If you concentrate on the soldiers and their bravery and their heroism and their suffering, you don't ask those big questions. What were they doing there? What possible advantage was there to Australia? Now, in the small town I lived just outside Hobart, there were 40 young men from that district who died in the First World War, and there were three brothers from where I live now. Now, whatever were they doing there? What possible advantage was it to Australia for them to be there? It would have been far better for Australia if they'd all stayed home and raised families and helped develop the country. But we can't, because the sacrifice, we can't say it was pointless. Mm. We can't say that.
Well, we were perhaps more able to have that conversation 30 or 40 years ago than we are today.
Absolutely, yes, yes.
You think that those who were killed in the frontier wars should be formally recognised by the Australian War Memorial. I understand the former Governor-General, Sir William Dean, is also of this view. Have you personally lobbied Dr. Brendan Nelson about this?
No, I haven't.
Had I picked up the phone and had a chat to him?
Well, that would be interesting. That would be interesting. There's a great deal of resistance to this. I mean, I think two things have to happen. I mean, one, I think settler Australia has to do its own thing. Now, I think there then has to be the capacity for Indigenous Australia to decide how and when and what they will do that this becomes a recognition. Now, as we know, every small town in the country has got a war memorial, and from the Second World War, it's a swimming pool or a community hall. There is this tremendous recognition of the importance of war right across the landscape. Now, it would seem to me that what, as part of this project, is that There's a serious engagement with Indigenous Australia, and now that there are so many organisations that have grown up as a result of land claims, the whole of Australia has proper organisations representing distinctive groups, distinctive nations, and they be asked to discuss the question over a period of years as to how they would want this conflict to be recognised. Now, there's only one monument that I'm aware of in Australia, and I can't remember exactly where it is, that is a monument to the people who were killed during the settlement of Australia, black and white. But there's only one. Mm. Now, many Indigenous groups may say, no, we don't want to do anything. That's fine. That's up to them. But others may say, yes, we would like to do this and this and this. They may well want to have something in Canberra. They may well want something on their own country. And that should be funded as lavishly as we fund the question of the war dead. As you know, we spend vast amounts of money. If we go and dig bodies up now. We dig them up on the Western Front, of all places, and we spend a great deal of money to bring these people out of the ground and find out who they are. In many cases, going and telling relatives, did you realise, I mean, people who had never thought about this are sort of in a way shamed into recognising that it was Great Uncle Bert that they probably didn't know about. So there's a vast industry. Now, if that's what we're going to do with our war dead, we've got to say, are these people our countrymen or not?
Mm. Just on Brendan Nelson, he gave a speech to the National Press Club yesterday when he was asked specifically why the tens of thousands of Indigenous Australians who died in the frontier wars were not recognised by the memorial, why it refused to tell their story. He replied that he thought it was a very important story to be told, but that the War Memorial was not the institution to tell that story.
Well, that's fine. If that's the War Memorial, there should be a separate institution that has a quarter of the War Memorial's funding. You know, they can sacrifice. If they don't want to do it, that's fine.
He said, actually, that the National Museum of Australia was the place where the right and proper place for this to take place.
But yes, I mean, it may well be that we need a separate institution, and if the War Memorial can't do it, then there has to be an alternative.
Mm. There's a certain gravitas, though, isn't there, about having your story represented in the War Memorial?
That's absolutely right. And that's why, if we are to pay our respects to the Indigenous patriots who died defending their country and their way of life, then that is the place for them.
It's interesting because we've reached the stage where we are better at acknowledging the contribution that Indigenous Australians made fighting the sort of empire wars. And in fact, Aboriginal and Islander families are encouraged to remember their forebears in that regard, but not those who died fighting in the frontier wars.
I mean, that's in a way the response. That is to spend a lot of money on the black diggers. And academics being academics, I mean, there are people who are running after the money, of which there's endless amounts to do just that. Now, of course, that needs to be done. No one doubts that. But to spend all this money on those who are fighting for the empire and simply ignore those who are fighting against it is quite extraordinary. Mm. And it's partly, apart from that whole question of the way we regard war, it's the way we see our history in a post-European era. I mean, the world of European imperialism is over. You know, we are now entering a totally different era, and Australia has to decide, are we going to go on seeing what was important, that we were engaged as adjuncts to British and American imperialism, or are we going to talk much more about our own history and our own place? Mm. And that's why it seems to me that we have to say that the war here was more important than the wars that we were engaged in. Particularly with, let's remember that Anzac was the beginning of the ability for the Europeans, for the first time in 500 years, to smash into the Middle East, to smash into the Middle East, destroy the Ottoman Empire, and create those client states, which are still in massive trouble because of what happened then. And that is what we don't come to terms with. We don't come to terms with why we went to war and whether, you know, and I mean, one of the extraordinary things we are talking about, let's commemorate the Boer War. Now, for God's sake, the Boer War resulted in the death of something like 40,000 mainly children in British concentration camps, and they were called concentration camps. These were war crimes even at the time. How can we possibly say we have to now commemorate the Boer War and put up a new monument down there in Canberra? It is because we won't come to terms, because we innocent ourselves. We say, it wasn't our fault, we just went along to be heroic. We are unwilling to accept the moral responsibility of going to war.
Why? Why are we uncomfortable confronting these historic truths and uncomfortable having a broader and bigger conversation about these issues of war?
Well, because it is easy for Australia. Australia, in almost every war we've fought, we didn't choose who we fought, when we fought, how we fought, where we fought. These were all decided for us. So the political, moral, legal, strategic decisions to go for war were made by other people.
You talk about the importance of acknowledging these wars if we are to achieve some degree of reconciliation. You point out, ironically enough, that Reconciliation Place in Canberra does not refer to frontier conflict in any way. But beyond the memorials, beyond the commemoration, how should the story be told? And what sort of story do we tell? I mean, is this a story where we need to apportion some degree of blame? You write in your book that the dispossession of Aborigines and Islanders, the assumption of sovereignty, the violence that accompanied all of this, was one of the greatest appropriations of land in world history. How do we have an honest, frank discussion, retelling of our story that doesn't make people feel ashamed of where they're from and their country's history?
Well, there are countries that have had to face up to the most dreadful things. I mean, if the Germans can come to terms with Nazism and the Holocaust, we can come to terms with this. If the Poles can come to terms with their appalling history, and I mean, just recently saying, look, Germans are now our best friends, and we don't want the Germans to stay out of Poland, we want them to come into, you know. Nations do this, and I see absolutely no reason, but it brings that question of how British are we? Are we still British, you know? Now, I find that offensive, and I find it offensive that I was staying in town today, that over Anzac Place, there's a Union Jack flying, a foreign flag. And what's it doing there, for God's sake? You know, how British are we? How much longer do we want to be British? What future is there in being British in this new world? We simply have to turn our history around. Mm. And I see no reason why we can't identify with the Aborigines.
Mm. We now have bipartisan support, in principle at least, to formally acknowledge Indigenous Australians in the nation's constitution. The timetable for the referendum has blown out somewhat, and there are a range of different proposals, I know. But do you think the frontier wars should inform this constitutional acknowledgement?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, how can you say you identify people in the Constitution without identifying, what it was that brought our current situation about? But above all, there has to be a resolution of this question of sovereignty. Mm. If the Indigenous nations were sovereign, and I would argue there's no doubt they were, then how and by what means was sovereignty acquired by the British? Mm-hmm. And there's a great hole in our thinking, but above all in our jurisprudence, because it hasn't been dealt with.
Well, because the High Court went part of the way, didn't they? They went part of the way by throwing out terra nullius,
yes,
but then refused to challenge the sovereignty of the Crown.
Yes, well, Mabo himself would have wanted sovereignty to be discussed, but he was, quite sensibly his legal people said, for Christ's sake, no, let's just get property accepted. Mm. But by implication, I mean, if these nations had land law, which can be incorporated within the common law, then they must have had sovereignty. Mm. But there is no resolution of that question. And as I say, if the Australian courts say, no, we can't deal with that because it is that act of sovereignty which led to our creation, we can't go behind that, then, as I say, the only place would seem to me to be, you can go and ask for an opinion of the International Court of Justice.
Mm. There are a number of other books slated on the sort of terrain that you cover in this book, Henry, and there's also been just recently Timothy Bottom's book released, and he spoke on big ideas as well. Is this an indication that we're perhaps ready for having this difficult national conversation?
Well, I think in the last 10 years, a lot more work has been done, a lot of very good work in many parts of Australia. And, I mean, there's a wonderful book coming out from a student of mine on the Black War in Tasmania that UQP is publishing quite soon, I think, and that is a stunning book. Mm. There is a lot more work, and the more work there is, the greater difficulty we have in saying, well, we don't have to deal with it. And I think the work being done by people here in Brisbane is probably the most important work. And that's partly because the Queensland has such a vast amount of material. I mean, there are important documents that don't exist, but my goodness me, there's a great wealth of documentation. And because Queensland has such a vast territory that the settlers moved into in a period when there was no oversight from the imperial government, it is the epicentre of the conflict. There's no doubt about that. And so, yes, I think ultimately the evidence is piling up. And anyone who is going to write serious history of Australia has to come to terms with it. Now, whether that affects the public view, I mean, I don't think our new government will show any interest whatsoever in this.
I was going to ask you that. I mean, could your book and subsequent books re-trigger the History Wars sort of volume two?
Oh, quite possibly, but I think they'll simply ignore it. I think that's been the, that it's best not to give publicity. But who knows?
How draining did you find that whole period, by the way, of the History Wars? I mean, it was an incredibly vitriolic period of dispute and personal abuse, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I mean, Lyndall Ryan suffered far more than I did. But no, it wasn't pleasant. But I mean, I was a controversialist in those days when I was a young fella. I dished out a lot of attacks on other people. You know, if you're going to get into public fights, you've got to be able to take the blows back. Mm. But yes, there were times when it was distressing. I remember I was also living when I still do with a Queensland politician. So I knew public life was not a gentle place.
Not a bed of roses.
No.
Henry, it's been terrific talking to you. Will you please thank Henry Reynolds? Historian Henry Reynolds, author of The Forgotten War, speaking with me at Avid Reader in Brisbane. More details are available at abc.net.au. Head to the RN homepage and you can find us on the program menu from where you can download or podcast this and other Big Ideas discussions.